So welcome to the Dharma Talk. The theme is the freeing of the mind. So during the past decade, we in the West have become much more aware of attacks on innocent civilians, more aware of the kinds of bombings and atrocities that have been going on in some cultures for many decades, even longer, if not centuries. In 2006, we saw the bombing of Varanasi, a city in India, where some of us often go for teachings and for meditation practice. It's rather close to Sarnath, which is where the Buddha gave his first discourse long ago. My daughter often travels in India, as do I, and she was there at the time of these particular bombings that I'm referring to. And it was a terrible day because there were two bombs that exploded at the railway station, another in a Hindu temple, a very important Hindu temple in Varanasi, where a wedding was taking place. And there were a number of other bombs that the military, thankfully, could defuse. And I know this is nothing new for all of you, living with this kind of fear, living with this kind of situation that can come about. And so without going into any more kind of gruesome details about what actually did happen on that day, it led me to wondering, well, since we have come to this kind of situation in this world of ours, what does the Dharma actually tell us about how to deal with conflict and the resolution of conflict? There's a very famous sutta, and it's called the Madhupindika Sutta, or the Honeyball Sutta. Those of you who know the Dharma well will know it. In India, there's a sweet, and it's called a kekadam, and it's round like this, and it's a rosewater honey ball that melts in one's mouth. And the Buddha said, if you can understand this sutta, it's as sweet as a honey ball. And I think it's rather lovely because these honey balls were being sold on the streets of Varanasi then, so long ago, and they're still there. The sweet shops are still right there, selling the same type of sweets. So if you go to Varanasi, make sure you have one. So not only is this understanding sweet, but it actually brings an end to any desire to be violent. When we understand it, aggression ends. So it seems to me that it's rather important in this world of ours. So there's a word that's used in the sutta rather a lot. It's a Pali word, papancha or papancha. And its translation is thought proliferation. But it's not quite as simple as that. What it actually refers to is the projection of mind that emerges as a result of the process of perception and cognition, perception and thinking. So, let me try to explain. When we open our eyes, the world of phenomena is immediately before us. There's contact through the eyes or through the spectacles if you're as blind as me. And then there's simply colour, there's bare sense data. And so rather quickly I realise immediately I'm actually in the Dharma hall at Endor. So this process is affected by memory from the past. So this is perception, it's based on memory and association. And I'm telling you this before I read you the section in the sutta because it's a little weighty and difficult to understand, especially with the translation. The sutta goes like this. Dependent upon the eye, so this is the iwaii, the actual organ, the eye, dependent upon the eye and forms, eye consciousness arises. The meeting of the three is contact. With contact as condition, there is feeling. What one feels, that one perceives. What one perceives, that one thinks about. What one thinks about, that one mentally proliferates. Okay, so we see, we feel, we perceive, then we think about that, and then we have another thought about that. And then the thoughts become thoughts about the thoughts. Or we might have another feeling and have a thought about that. And in this way, our thinking process occurs. The sutta goes on to say that in this tangle of feelings, perceptions, that this tangle of feelings, perceptions, and thoughts besets us with respect to the past, the present, and the future. That is, in the three fields of time. The next step that happens is we project with the thoughts and we overlay reality with a capital R. With our projections and experiences from the past, our distorted perceptions. Our perception isn't trouble-free, it's actually distorted based on our past experience, whatever that may be. Our projections are also coloured by our unconscious desires, so our desires that we're not really aware of. And so this process is going on throughout the day and in relationship to others and to the world around us. We find some people, objects and ideas attractive and others unattractive. And so in life, consciousness is rather compelled, if we don't catch it, if we don't catch this process happening, consciousness is thrown about, it's compelled by our likes and dislikes, our attractions and aversions. Now I know I've said this a number of times already on this retreat, but I cannot stress how important it is to understand that as the movement of mind. We see the mind moving in different directions as we go about our activities of the day. And some of the movement of mind is completely unproblematic, but some of it is not, because we're unaware and we carry with us all kinds of prejudices and views and opinions that, if we're not careful, lead to harm. They lead to aggression, they lead to violence, they lead to conflict. This only happens when we grip hold and cling to our identity, our craving, and our views. So, one has thoughts about that which one perceives. So we perceive things and then we have thoughts about them. So this is thoughts, ideas, judgments, views, opinions. And these associations get loaded by our emotions. according to our background, our culture, the nation we live in, our religion. And so these notions are colored and distorted. So we don't see clearly, is the point that I'm making. And for example, there's a couple of classic issues that happen on meditation retreats. One of them is we have what's called the VR, the Vipassana romance. We see someone who looks attractive. We see someone who's pleasing to us, and we immediately have some kind of fantasy. Maybe the person sat next to us at lunch. Maybe they pitched their tent next to us. Maybe they put their shoes next to ours. And with these tiny, rather insignificant things, the mind can go wild and we can start thinking, oh, he or she is attracted to us. He or she loves us. Or we can have the opposite. We have the Vipassana villain, it's called. This is the person we just simply can't stand. And they can't do anything right. They breathe too loudly. We don't like the way they walk. We don't like the colour of their hair. We can't stand the noise they make when they sit down. Or they come in late. Every session. And so you see, there's all of this. And then, of course, there's the person who snores. And so this is the movement of the mind. So we invent, the villain. I taught a retreat once where there was a woman sitting in the middle of the room. By the end of the retreat, there was a whole big circle around her. Because nobody wanted to sit next to her. It was extraordinary. I mean, she did have some rather loud views and opinions about my teaching. The most classic one was she said, "Your teaching is so shallow." And I went, "Wow, I've never been on the end of that projection before. It's usually the opposite. Your teaching is way too deep. We can't understand it." So I thought it was quite hilarious, but we can have these projections in our mind about somebody. Or we can go further than projections. We can actually say and act according to them. So this is to be understood. And a silly kind of example from my own life. A few years ago, I was sleeping away in my bed at home. My mobile phone rang in the middle of the night. I hadn't put it on silent. And I could see on the phone that it was an international call. And I tried to listen to the message in the middle of the night. So first of all, I'm thinking, oh, who would be calling me from overseas in the middle of the night? Who do I know who's traveling? Of course, I landed on, mother, and my daughter was traveling overseas. So I listened to the message. I can't understand it. Can't understand the message. Did not appear to be her voice. It was the voice of a man, and I'm listening and listening and playing the message over and over. Is it a Middle Eastern voice? Is it an Indian voice? I just couldn't hear it. And so I thought, oh, never mind, it's probably just a wrong number. So then, of course, I try to go back to sleep. And then I think, oh, well, maybe it's my daughter. And I think, oh, maybe she's lost her phone and someone's called the number that says mum. And then I start thinking all of these things. And before long, I'm in this catastrophic and dramatic thought process where I'm thinking, my daughter's been kidnapped and this is the ransom message and I can't understand it. And so then I think, don't be ridiculous, go back to sleep. But then, of course, I couldn't. And so then I thought, okay, if something's happened to her and I don't call her, will I feel terrible? And I thought, yes. And so there I call her. And I get this cheery, hi, Mum. Oh, no, I'm fine. I'm just in London walking to the underground. And then I think, oh, no, the underground. The underground in London. There's been attacks there. You know, this is papancha. This is the craziness of the mind. It was just a sound in my room. And we build with our thought process some kind of dramatic scenario. So, in the sutta, there are three kinds of papancha, three types. There's maybe a couple of additional types, but three main types. And one of them is the thought formations that coalesce around desire. They coalesce around the mind that's wanting, and these are fueled by attraction. They're fueled by desire, expectations, and they include things like the projection of our neediness upon another, or the desire for objects, things. Another type of papancha is papancha around views, the kind of thought process and thought proliferation that jumps to conclusions, or that forms opinions, or holds on to concepts or ideas or particular prejudices. So all preconceived ideas we have about somebody or something, whether it's another country, another person, another religion, they all fit into this category. And the third type is thought formations that form and solidify around identity, around conceit. And these can be particularly problematic because they're the ones that we've been talking about over the days around self, how we are and how we'd like to be and are not quite. Other suggested possibilities for papancha are projections of fears. When we're really, really bound up in fear, that distorts our actions and colours consciousness. And in the world of politics, you know, fear is used mercilessly by people to win votes. In Australia, right now, we have this extraordinary and horrific situation with refugees wanting to come, and those boats being turned back, so-called, people not being allowed to arrive by boat, being sent to what are essentially prison camps, not only families, but not only adults, but children as well. And I'm horrified to think of this, but children and people who arrive and who are kept in those camps on Manus Island in New Guinea and in Nauru in the Pacific are given numbers rather than names. And I just find this unbelievable, absolutely unbelievable and horrific, given what we know of the history of we human beings on this planet and what we're capable of. And that suffering of all those refugees who come is kept in place because of fear, because ordinary Australians, so-called, fear someone who is different, fear that someone's going to come and take our jobs, for heaven's sake. We live in this huge land with a tiny population. It is a kind of mental madness, and yet this division based on nationality, this division based on race, this division based on religion, brings about incredible atrocities and just inhumane treatment of other human beings. And it's a great shame, as I see it, to the nation that I call home. It's absolutely terrible. And I think here too there are refugees who come and who are, of course, met with some kindness, but also with its opposite. So in order to see an end to this conflict, we have to understand this process of mind, how it occurs, and how we divide the world into other and self, how we see in this dualistic and divisive way. We have to understand the mechanism of mind, because when we understand it, we can cut through it altogether. So what keeps this process alive is clinging to craving, clinging to conceit or identity, and clinging to views. So this is mine, the view, this is mine, is based on craving. So we want something, and we bring it towards us, we claim it. This I am is a conceit, this is identification. And this is myself is a view. So I'm a teacher sitting here right now. This is a view, for example. So Krishnamurti says, meditation is the freeing of the mind from all symbols, images, and remembrances. So when we really see mind in its purity, without clinging, anywhere, there's a freeing up of the mind that occurs. And to come back to my story in Varanasi of my daughter and the day of the bombings, she happened to be walking in the main old part of town. She was going to meet a friend of mine. And a policeman said to her, "I'm sorry, madam, you can't walk here. There's a bomb." So she said, "Fair enough, I'll go the other way." So she very quickly took the policeman's advice. And some friends of mine heard, they were telephoned by other friends, about the explosions that were taking place in various parts around Varanasi, and a wonderful Egyptian friend of mine literally grabbed my daughter, put her in a cycle rickshaw, and took her about 3 or 4 kilometres back to her hotel, where the owner of the hotel, thankfully, had the sense to actually lock the gates and shut everybody inside and tell her not to go outside. She was in her early 20s then and quite politically naive about what that meant. So, to continue the story, the Mahant of Varanasi, who was a very good friend of mine, a wonderful, wonderful man, was at the temple doing the evening prayers when, and there was a wedding in progress, when the bomb exploded, killing people. He said, "Radha, I have never seen anything so horrible in all my life." He said, "Body parts were everywhere." But he, in that situation, thought, "Okay, I will continue doing what I'm doing." And so he continued with the prayers and the chanting, and kept everybody relatively steady in spite of the chaos. Of course, the police came and ambulances came, and there was chaos everywhere. And so then he said, "Well, I needed to decide what to do." An angry crowd gathered outside the temple, an angry crowd of Hindus wanting retribution. And so Mahanchi, this wonderful, he was the high priest of the Hindu culture in Varanasi, which is a Hindu city. He stood with Sonia Gandhi by his side and the leader of the Islamic community. And all three of them stood together. And they faced the crowd. And he said, he talked to them and told them that to seek retribution was not the way. To continue with the killing was not the way. And so he managed to calm them and talk them down and keep the peace. He and the others made some combined statements to the media, being very careful not to inflame the situation in any way. The whole of the Muslim part of Varanasi decided to shut down out of respect for the loss and the deaths of the Hindus. This was wonderful. This was a great gesture. So instead of dividing the community, those who attacked had actually brought them together. And then something remarkable happened. Some Muslim musicians came, and they came to the Hindu temple, and they played Hindu songs as a gesture of peace and of goodwill and of reconciliation. So it was extraordinary. It was an extraordinary coming together. And Mahanchi said, he said, it's as if I am now the leader of the Islamic community as well. He said, I get more invitations to functions and events with them than I do with the Hindus. And he said, the fact that we could stand together side by side really brought the peace. So I thanked him very much for keeping the peace in India. Those of you who know the history will know how volatile a situation like that is. When there's some kind of killing, then of course somebody gets the blame, whether it was them or not. And then there's the conflict between the Muslims and the Hindus, and some fairly dangerous and outrageous behavior. So when I thanked Mahanchi for keeping the peace in India, his eyes just filled with tears. And he said, but Rataji, what else would I do? What else would I do but be the voice of peace? So I honor him for having that wisdom to step through the divide and the division of one set of people and another. And of course, this has implications for peace everywhere. This is what needs to be done. The voices of peace need to be listened to and heard. And now another story. And now another story to illustrate this clinging to craving, conceit, and views, and how it leads to difficulty and division. Several years ago now, in Tasmania — Tasmania's an island state in Australia that's far south — and there's a lot of mining that happens there, and the mining triggered an earthquake And three of the miners were trapped beneath the ground. After a day or so, rescue workers found one person who had unfortunately been killed by a rockfall. They continued to look for the other two, and after 5 days, it was widely thought that they must have been killed also. But they weren't. And it turned out that they survived 2 weeks underground. And then were rescued. So initially, the earthquake occurred, and one man, and just imagine this, was buried in rock up to his neck. He was totally buried. And there he was, a kilometer under the ground, buried in rock to his neck. And so he started shouting, and nobody came. There was one other person alive, but he'd been knocked unconscious. Eventually, that man came too and came to his rescue. The man buried up to his neck said, "I couldn't breathe." This is mindfulness of breathing practice. He said the pressure of the rocks was extreme. And one by one, his friend had to, or the other person, the other miner, had to take the rocks and stack them. They were trapped in a little section, 3 meters by 4 meters. Tiny. They couldn't stand up properly. And when they stacked the rocks, they had to stack them carefully so that they didn't take up too much space. And it took 4 hours to free him. So there they were, the two of them. So then they began to speak to one another. They're sitting side by side in a cave, a kilometer under the ground. You can imagine the thoughts, can't you? Imagine the fear. Imagine what you would be thinking. And they began to speak to one another. They're two Australian men. So you know what they said. They said, "What kind of cars do you like?" And this is true. And one said, "Well, I like Fords." And the other one said, "Oh, I can't stand Fords. I hate them. I like Holdens, which is an Australian car." And so they disagreed about the cars. And so they thought, well, we'll try another conversation. And so they said, "What do you like to do on the weekend?" And so one said, "Oh, I like to go hunting and shooting and fishing." And the other one said, "Oh no, I hate that. I'm a vegetarian." And so whenever they tried to talk about something, they couldn't find any common ground. There was literally nothing that these two men agreed about. They didn't agree about politics. So imagine that. You're stuck underground. You're with somebody, it might be the last day of your life, and you're with somebody else, and you can't agree about a single thing. This is human beings. It's extraordinary. So there they were, under the ground. And the days went by, and they heard no sound of rescue. So they had some pens. Whoops. They had some pens and they wrote letters on their clothes and on their bodies to their loved ones to say goodbye. So that when their bodies were found, people would know that they had lived for some days. So they wrote the letters, and then the extraordinary thing happened is they read the letters to each other. And it was then, and only then, that they discovered any meeting point between the two of them. only the love that they had for their families, cross the divide of the views and ideas and opinions that they held. And so it was in the sharing of this that the two of them became friends. Their differences in lifestyle and views and opinions were so great that it was only this that managed to cross the divide. So eventually they heard the sounds of blasting the rock. The rock was very hard. And they were miners, and they knew that from the way that the explosives were happening, that whoever was doing it wasn't looking for them alive. They were looking for their bodies. And so they wrote on their clothing the time and the date of each explosion, so that when their bodies were found, we would know what time everyone would know when they died. Because with each explosion, their little cave began to get smaller and smaller. So they shouted, "We're alive, we're alive," over and over again, until eventually somebody heard them. And so, of course, a pipe was pushed through the loose rock so that they finally had some communication with the outside world. And then the rescuers said, "What would you like us to pass you through the pipe?" And of course they said things like bacon and eggs. And the rescuers said, "No, you haven't eaten for 9 days. You can't have that. You can have yogurt or some kind of terrible gel stuff." And so they weren't so happy about that. And then again they said, "What can we pass you through this pipe?" And one of the miners said, "I want a Saturday paper." And the rescuers were like, "What? Why does he want a Saturday paper?" And he said, "To look for a new job." So this is Australian humour. This is our sense of humour. It's quite extraordinary. And then over the days, see, once they'd found them, they still actually couldn't get them out. And so they had to stay in this little cave for a few more days. So of course they passed them a kind of rolled up yoga mat or something to lie on. And they passed them a light and a few things to make them comfortable. And the rescuers said, "What's it like in there?" And they said, "Oh, it's 2-star. And we are the 2 stars. So humour also helps us through. Humour helps us navigate the differences. Humour helps us with these incredibly difficult situations in our life. But to come back to the sutta, and this is the really important part of the sutta, I think. What the Buddha says, he says, when we understand this sutta, so we understand, we understand this mechanism of mind where we cling and hold to craving, to conceit, identity. You know, I'm an Australian, I'm Israeli, I'm Palestinian, or whatever. I'm Indian, I'm English. This is the I, holding to identity. So this mechanism clings to craving, conceit, and views we have about ourselves and others. Clinging there is the cause of all conflict everywhere. When we understand this sutta, the sutta goes like this. This is the end of resorting to rods and weapons, of quarrels, brawls, disputes, recrimination, malicious words, and false speech. Here these evil, unwholesome states cease without remainder. So when we really see that clinging to these three areas, these three springs of papancha, colors and shapes consciousness, and leads to all forms of suffering and conflict. When we really see that and let it go, we have the capacity to free the heart and mind. And when the heart and mind is free, there's peace. And when the heart and mind is free, we are, as Mahanchi was, the voice of peace in this world. And just to finish with a Rumi poem, a slightly edited Rumi poem. It goes like this. It's called Only Breath, and I know that some of you will know it. Not Christian or Jew, or Muslim, not Hindu, Buddhist, Sufi, or Zen, not any religion or cultural system. I'm not from the East or the West, not out of the ocean or up from the ground, not natural or ethereal, not composed of elements at all. And then he goes on. I'm not an entity in this world or the next. My place is placeless, a trace of the traceless. Neither body or soul, I belong to the beloved. Have seen the two worlds as one. First, last, outer, inner. Only that breath, breathing human being. Let's just sit quietly. May all beings see into the nature of papancha. May all violence and division in this world come to an end. And may all beings live with a heart and mind of peace.